Wake up! Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. You are now listening to You and Me at 30. I'm your host, Dr. Joshua K. Wright. I realize that you could be anywhere in the world right now, but you're here listening to me, and I sincerely appreciate that. You and Me at 30 is a new talk show airing on Sunday mornings. I'll be bringing you lively, thought-provoking discussion on a variety of topics. Each show will feature an extended conversation with a guest. While many of these individuals will come from the University of Maryland Eastern Shore and the local community, I will also feature several guests from around the country. Please note that the views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of 91.3 WESM or the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. My guest this morning is Judge George Hazel. In September 2013, President Barack Obama nominated Mr. Hazel to serve as a United States District Judge of the U.S. District Court for the District of Maryland. The Senate voted 95-0 to confirm George Hazel, making him the youngest district judge in the nation. Judge Hazel, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Wright. It's always a pleasure to be with you. I always enjoy the conversations we have in person. I'm looking forward to enjoying this conversation as well. It's my pleasure.
If you don't mind me asking, how old were you when President Obama nominated you to become a district judge?
I don't mind you asking at all. When I first applied, I was actually 37. Then when I got the nomination, I was 38. And then by the time I got confirmed, I was 39 years old. So the process takes some time. You age as you're going through the process. So by the time I was actually on the bench, I was 39. The nomination took place when I was 38.
Wow, wow. And take us from the very beginning, when you were a child, up until that momentous achievement. What was your path to success?
Sure. So look, I remember growing up as a kid in Queens, New York. I always felt like I wanted to be involved in public service in some way, and wanted to do something not completely unlike what I'm doing now. And I think one of the important things for me during my youth was that I had role models. I went to a church, I was called a local church, but it's pretty big, Allen, at the time AME Church, now it's known as the Great Allen Cathedral. And both then and now, the pastor was Floyd Flake. Now, at the time, Floyd Flake was a congressman, right? He started out when I was a kid, he was my pastor. At some point, he ran for Congress. And I remember going to his inauguration and just looking up and being like, wow, that's awesome. He looks like me. He's someone who I know. He's the pastor of my church. So that was just one of the things that sort of inspired me to think, if he can do that, I know him. I've had dinner with him. That I could accomplish, similar things. And just sort of, being around him and getting to meet other people like that. Like, that was just one of those things as a kid that was just really helpful for me, having those role models. And so, I went through, I started Allen Christian School, then went to high school, Jamaica High School in New York, and then from there went to Morehouse College. And certainly that was a formative time in my life. Again, just being around more great African-American achievement, that was something that continued to inspire me. From there, I went on to Georgetown Law School, which brought me to the nation's capital. The law was something I had always had an interest in, and so that just seemed like the next step. Again, I saw myself as wanting to be a leader, even going back from childhood, and so law school just seemed like a way to help me continue push in that direction. After law school, I had a lot of student loans, and so I spent about 5.5 years in private practice at a national law firm called Wild Actual and Mangies. And so, good luck trying to spell that. But I was there for 5.5 years. I learned a lot about the law. Made a decent amount of money in private practice, but I always knew that public service was my calling. So I went from there to becoming an assistant United States attorney, first in D.C., then in Maryland. I total did that for about 6 years, if you combine the two, handling all sorts of cases and really focusing most of my time on violent crime, first domestic violence, but then, just general violent crime later in my career. me to be his chief deputy state attorney. And so I went there to sort of help him reshape that office and run that office. And it was while I was there that I recall he was the first one to actually mention to me, hey, there's this opportunity to be a U.S. district judge, and you should apply. And so I applied for it and was fortunate enough to get it at that point. So that's the path that I took. Looking back, I don't know that I always planned to be a federal judge, but certainly I had plans that I wanted to be in public service. I wanted to be a leader in some way, and so that was the path that ultimately I think God sort of set out for me.
Explain to our listeners what a district judge is, because I know there are different types of judges. So what specifically is a district judge, and what is the typical workload for somebody in that position?
Sure. So in the federal system, the district judge is the trial judge, right? So in other systems, it's phrased differently. But in the federal system, the district judge is the trial judge. And then on top of the district judge, you'll have the circuit court judges, who are the appellate judges. And above that, you have the Supreme Court. So at the trial level, now I say trial judge, we're not actually physically in trial all day. We get a lot of motions. There are a lot of opinions, written opinions to write. That's probably how I spend the bulk of my time. But certainly when cases go to trial, either civil or criminal, they go to trial in front of me. And so, you know, it varies how many trials I do a year. It could be anywhere from two or three to seven or eight. Some of them might be two-day trials. I recently had a trial that lasted about 4 weeks. So that can vary. In terms of the workload, you know, I currently have somewhere in the neighborhood of 280 pending civil cases. And then I have somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 to 50 criminal cases. And that's probably relatively standard among my colleagues. The number of civil cases usually, as you can see, greatly outnumbers the criminal cases. But I will say, because the criminal cases involve almost entirely at least one person's liberty interest, we do tend to prioritize them. So when you see me in court, more often than not, I'm in court on a criminal matter. Whether it's someone going to trial, I always prioritize, it's true of most of my colleagues, I always prioritize a criminal trial over a civil trial. Because again, somebody is either sitting in jail, waiting for their day in court, or just wanting to know whether or not that's in their future, whether jail's in their future. So you want to give them their day as soon as possible. So when I'm physically in court, I'm usually handling criminal trials, criminal pleas, or criminal sentencing. That's probably 90% of the time I'm physically in court. 90% of the time I'm in my chambers, though, and this is the part you might not see as often, I'm working on written opinions, trying to get opinions out in a timely fashion. And that's certainly where I rely on my law clerks. I get two law clerks. I rely on my law clerks heavily to help me through that.
Now, I noticed that you said you had a very large number of cases that come your way, but in terms of going to trial, the number of trials you have was much lower. So you get a number of cases, and then you had to just determine, you know, like I'm assuming most of them never go to trial, so that's why the number of trials are so low.
Yeah, no, that's true. Most cases, you know, I've got the percentages, it's probably 90%, probably both criminal and civil, resolved short of trial. You know, in the criminal cases, you know, in federal court in particular, the federal government, and it's a little different in state court sometimes, but the federal government has, you know, so much in terms of resources, the ability to investigate cases ahead of time, that, and frankly, a high conviction rate, that, at trial that is, that, you know, if you're the defendant, it could be, it can feel overwhelming, the notion of saying, I'm going to actually take the government to trial. You know, and also the system is set up, you can say whether this is good or bad, but that you're usually, not always, but usually going to get sort of a better deal, quote unquote, if you take a plea than if you go to trial. Sometimes that difference can be enormous. Sometimes it's not as big. But I think that ends up being a factor in whether or not people decide to go to trial or not. You know, if you can get 6 months, 8 months, a couple of years in some cases, sometimes more. more than that knocked off by taking a plea, a lot of defendants are going to decide to just take their plea. I think another part of it is we also probably don't appreciate just the mental weight of having that hanging over you, such that, you know, sometimes I think you probably get pleas because they just want resolution. And, you know, a plea today at least resolves the issue rather than having it hang over your head for another 6 months to a year, hoping to get your day in court that way.
Interesting. Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to You and Me S 30. Today's guest is George Hazel, United States District Judge of the U.S. District Court for the District of Maryland. Judge Hazel, I'm really glad to talk to you right now, in particular because BET, the cable network, is currently airing a new docuseries called Finding Justice. And I was watching their most recent episode a few nights ago, and it was about the cash bail system. And in the episode, it begins by telling viewers that more than half of the entire jail population are people unable to pay bail. It was reported that in St. Louis, Missouri, 98% of prisoners at the main workhouse are there because they didn't have the money to pay the bail. The episode also references well-known cases like Khalif Browder, a black teenager in New York falsely accused of a crime who refused to take a plea deal. And he was not able to pay the $3,000 in bail, so he ended up being at Rikers Island for 3 years. When he finally came home, he committed suicide after just a few months. And then, according to the episode, over 70% of people who die in jail haven't been convicted of a crime. Over 35% of the deaths occur within the first week of arrest, suicide being the leading cause. So my question to you is, number one, how accurate are these statistics that BET's throwing out to viewers? And then also, what's your stance as a judge on the cash bail industry?
Sure. So that's sort of the first question. You know, I haven't looked at the stats. They don't strike me as being unreasonable. One of the things, I've been in different systems, and I'm grateful that the one I'm currently in the federal court where I sit, we actually don't use cash bail. We do what I think is our approach, is that we decide whether or not somebody is either too dangerous to be on the streets, right, like they're going to be a danger to someone if we put them back on the street pending trial, or if they're a risk of flight, right? So if you, if we look at your record and say, yeah, he's not shown up for court in the past, or he has some reason why we think he's going to flee, then based on that, you should be held. If we think, based on your background, you're going to be a danger to somebody and give them the charge, then you should be held. But if those things aren't true, then you shouldn't be held. And, you know, your ability to make a certain payment shouldn't really factor into that. Either those things are true or those things are not true. And so I certainly prefer the system in the courthouse where I sit, where we make that decision without regard to how much the defendant can pay, because then you just end up with people sitting in jail because they're too poor to make bail, and I just don't think that's appropriate.
Many people have called the justice system the new Jim Crow. In your opinion, do we need more reform when it comes to policing and sentencing? And if so, what does that form look like? Or what should it look like?
In terms of policing, I have a background on that, but I have to be a little careful just because, as some might know, there's actually a consent decree case involving the Baltimore Police Department, and that case is actually before our court. Now, it's not before me personally, but it's before our court, so I want to be careful about making public comments about police reform because, so all I'll say is, look, that case, if you want to study an interesting case study on the issue, I would certainly commend to your audience to follow what's going on with the Baltimore Police Department. And that's a good way to get a sense of, is that approach effective? Is it not effective? In terms of additional reforms, when you're talking about sentencing, I feel comfortable saying that most judges are not fans of mandatory minimums. I certainly would be one of those. Any reform that puts more decision-making power in the judge to look at the individual, I think, is important. So that means reducing the number of mandatory minimums. Changes have been made in recent years, but I think even more could be done in that regard. Because ultimately, I believe that when it comes time for sentencing, a judge needs to be able to look at the individual in front of them and decide, okay, this case is like the sort of regular case, and so yes, I'll give the sentence that would usually fit. But there might be cases where you say, all right, there's something different about this case, where I should have the ability to make a different decision and say, I'm going to factor this in or factor that in that does not sort of fit with a typical case. And I just think it's always dangerous where you have, Congress sort of painting with a broad brush and saying, if you commit this crime with this record, you get 20 years. And not having to look those people in the eye as they're presenting that sentence. I have to look an individual in the eye. I have to look their families in the eye and say, and the victim, if it's a victim crime, and say, this is the just sentence. And if my hands are cuffed by a mandatory minimum, I'm not really able to do that. And I just think that, to me, is sort of the core of any judge's job, is to be able to weigh all the factors, all the different issues, and look someone in the eye and say, I've considered all of that, and for that reason and that reason alone, I think this is the sentence that fits your individual background, history, and the offense that you committed in this case. Anything that reduces mandatory minimums, I tend to be in favor of.
As a young black judge, do you ever feel conflicted knowing that you had the power to save or indelibly change the lives of so many young black and brown men and women when you're up there in court?
So there's a challenge. I don't know that I feel conflicted. I feel in some ways uniquely qualified for it, I've been a prosecutor concerned about public safety. I am, and I have always been and will be until I die, an African-American male who has friends and family members who have been incarcerated. And so, I have seen both sides of it. And so I understand the impact that the criminal justice system can have on an African-American family. Like, I've seen it. What happens when that dad is pulled out of the family and the disruption that causes to that family. But I've also seen in my work the impact that crime has on African-American communities. And so I do think that public safety is necessary, that, I want, my grandmother, if she was still alive, to be able to live in a community where she feels safe. And so that requires some degree of public safety. But I want my cousin to be able to walk down the street and not be harassed by police officers, and not be, incarcerated and not treated as an individual, as I was alluding to earlier, by someone sitting on the bench who doesn't understand what that person has been through. So I just feel like my background, it helps me to understand certain issues. It's why diversity is so important. You get a variety of backgrounds on the bench, so that people bring different understandings. And then some of the things I'm talking about, I share with my colleagues, and they share their understandings and their backgrounds. And I think that's what ultimately makes the bench strong, is when you have people on the bench from a variety of backgrounds, variety of viewpoints, that are able to just bring that to bear in the work that they do.
Great, and I'm glad you mentioned that point about diversity, and I want to come to that in just a moment, but before I do that, I want to follow up with something you said earlier where you were talking about people taking the plea deals. I know that one complaint has been that a lot of people end up doing time because they've taken a plea deal simply because they didn't have the right representation in court, or they didn't have the money to necessarily go through with a full trial. They didn't think that it would work out in their favor, so they took a plea deal when maybe, in fact, they should not have done that in the first place. So in regards to that, I mean, is there something that we could do to kind of change that system so that we don't have people end up spending time in jail just because they took a plea deal because they didn't have the best representation in court?
So I guess I'd make a couple of points on that. One, it's important that we have good public defenders good, what we refer to as criminal justice act attorneys, people who can be appointed to someone who does not have the money to represent, who does not have the money to go out and sort of pay for a lawyer. It's so critical that we maintain a system where very good, very capable lawyers are representing individuals in those situations, because the level of your representation makes such a difference. And you can't have someone who's overworked, overburdened, can't focus on your case, and so they become part of the machinery themselves, just trying to get to their next case. Well, I'll plead this guy out so I can go to my next case. We need to make sure we're giving defender services the resources to give individual defendants the individual attention their cases need and deserve, so that they are able to do what's best for the client. And the other thing we also have to do is make sure we're getting cases to resolution, to trial, if that's the resolution, as promptly and efficiently as we can. Because I do think the stress of being under indictment can weigh on you to the point where you reach that point where you say, especially if you're being held, look, I'll just take a deal so that I just have resolution. We need to be, if someone wants a trial, we need to get them their trial dates, so that if that's what you want, you know this is the date you'll have it, and you can plan for that so it doesn't become sort of unduly stressful, more stressful than it just naturally would be.
And to come back to that point you were making about diversity, so you talked about having diversity with our judges, but also I know from past conversations we've had that you think that diversity is important when it comes to the jury, and you have a very strong opinion about jury duty, especially I think as it relates to minorities. So can you just share that briefly?
Sure, happy to. You know, one thing that I see that frustrates me, particularly from my perspective on the bench, is, I'll be engaged in jury selection, and we'll have an African-American defendant, and an African-American juror will come up and just trip over themselves to try to find reasons, excuses not to want to sit on jury duty. And look, I know it's a burden for everybody. There are things you'd rather be doing, but you cannot, at least I won't hear it, say, I don't want to sit on jury duty, I don't have time to sit on jury duty, and then go out later and complain about the criminal justice system and say the criminal justice system is unfair and it's locking up too many black and brown people, and it's locking people up for too long. You can't say that if you're not willing to participate in the system. And for most people, sitting on a jury is your opportunity to participate. And what I'll hear people say sometimes is, oh, I can't be fair, because I think the criminal justice system is wrong. I think police officers lie, like they lied on my cousin, whatever the case might be. And one of the things they try to explain to people is, look, if you have a different perspective on policing, if you have a perspective that says, you know what, I'm skeptical of police, you know what, I'm skeptical of the government, then you know what, you need to be on a jury. Because you'll balance out the person who says, what are you talking about? I come from a family of cops, and all of my family members are either prosecutors or cops. There needs to be that balance, because that person, I promise you, wants to be on a jury, because they believe in the system. And so we need balance and diversity in juries. And so I'm always trying to push people to say, yes, serve on a jury and let your voice be heard.
So we have a minute left. Before we conclude, my last two questions are these. What criminal justice issue would you like to see our current 2020 candidates address in their platforms as they're running for office? And then secondly, do you have any advice for listeners who may have family members right now that are caught up in the justice system?
So the first question, I try as a judge not to get too much into politics. I'll just say quickly, as I was indicating before, to the extent that we do things to give judges more opportunities to apply their reasoning to individual cases, I'm always going to be in favor of that. In terms of the second question, again, I think we alluded to this before, the idea is getting the best representation you can get. Often it is the case, and it's the case in my courtroom, I'm proud to say, that the Federal Defender's Office is really, really good and filled with talented lawyers, and sometimes that's the best lawyer you can get. But that's not true in every community. So know what your options are for getting a good lawyer, because having adequate representation shared resource advocate on your side. You know, and again, that might be a public defender's office in some places. In some places, it might not be. Do whatever you can to find out, get information about who the good lawyers are in the courthouse your loved one is in, so that you can do the best you can to have someone like that representing the person you care about.
All right, unfortunately, we are out of time, but it's been a pleasure talking with you this morning, Judge Hazel.
My pleasure as well.
Okay, thank you so much. You have a great day.
All right, take care. Talk soon.
We end each show with a segment called Parting Shots. Here I give my thoughts on something happening in the news, pop culture, or life in general that's piqued my interest. A few weeks ago, I interviewed Gene Smith, the team captain of the 1984 Georgetown University Hoyas basketball team that won the men's national championship. Did you know that the Hoyas are responsible for March Madness and the reason for all of those brackets that you've been filling out this past month? In the 1989 NCAA tournament, the Hoyas were the overall number one seed, and they squeaked by Princeton University, who was the 16th seed, with a 50-49 win. Neither team held more than a 2-point lead for the game's final 10 minutes. The game aired on ESPN, so only those who had access to cable were able to watch it. At the time, the tournament games were not being broadcast the way they are today. The excitement from the Georgetown-Princeton game inspired CBS to sign a $1 billion, 7-year deal to broadcast the entire tournament for the final 3 weeks of March. And as they say, the rest is history. And that's our show for the week. Thanks again to our guest, George Hazel. We do this every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. If you like the show, please tell your friends about it. Like us on Facebook. A special shout out, as always, to Uncle Phil and Aunt Viv. Have a blessed day.